Today wraps up this round of the Founder Origin Story series. We do have this on the roadmap to do again next summer. So if you have a founder in mind that you absolutely want to hear from, you want to hear about his or her background, where they came from, how they grew up, how they were shaped, then please send us an email, tweet at us, get in touch with us somehow and submit their name. And we'd love to get them on the deck for the next round. But we're ending the series today with Rob's origin story. So we talk about some things that I don't think we've actually talked about on the podcast anywhere else, or that he hasn't talked about that publicly. His early experiences of learning to code on an Apple IIe, his early experiences writing comics, inventing things, and being an entrepreneur, selling candy at school, selling other things. And we also talk in this interview about the central role that his dad played in both helping him learn how to cope with hard things, to face anxiety, but also in terms of building up his belief in himself and in his own ability to contribute meaningfully to the world. So it's a good interview. There's a little bit of crying, but it's mostly by me. So thanks for listening to the series. And we have a lot of things coming up this fall. Love to see any of you join us for Business of Software in Boston in September. Rob and I will both be at MicroConf Europe in Lisbon in November. And we're doing a lot of other kind of traveling and speaking. We're hosting a retreat, hosting some Zen tribe groups. So all of that, of course, is available on the Zen Founder website. And feel free to be in touch with us if you are listening to the podcast and you realize there's something that we might be able to do to help bring a little bit more Zen to you or to your business. You know how to get a hold of us.
We plan to talk through the issues faced by startup founders and the people close to them.
Overused phrase, work-life balance.
It is an amazingly focusing time.
This is what we do, you know, aside from our families, this is our whole work life.
I am also known as Dr. Wine.
We know this woman is not traditional.
A little more Zen in the startup life.
Founder. Those days were a mental struggle.
I have been stressed in the past, and I know that I will be in the future.
A founder and his or her significant other would both get value from the episode.
It's a little bit funny to interview you about this since I know a lot about your life story, but I think it's a really interesting story and it'll be good for listeners to hear this part of you, which I don't know that you've shared a lot publicly.
Yeah, I haven't really had the chance. I think like a lot of folks that you've interviewed for this series, there hasn't really been a venue to talk about growing up, you know, because typically we start with, there's often the question of, were you an entrepreneur when you were a kid? And then that's it. And then it moves on. It's like, okay, so take us to when you started the business. And we kind of skip through that. So I really haven't gone in depth about growing up and what my formative years look like.
I think it is important to have that time to talk about the development of the founder, not just the development of the business. So I'm glad we're doing this. So let's maybe start from the beginning. Where were you born? Where did you grow up?
I was born in Santa Clara, California. I grew up basically in the South Bay and then in the East Bay Area. So what's interesting is I didn't realize growing up that the Bay Area was different than kind of the rest of the world. And so seeing billboards for computer chips and manufacturers, it was like Intel, and then there were biotech. And I didn't realize that the whole world wasn't all about technology. It just kind of was all around me.
You didn't know that you were in the epicenter of the technological revolution.
Yeah, that's right. And what's a trip is like all the stories you hear about, you know, Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs and the Homebrew Computer Club and all that stuff. I mean, that stuff happened 20, 30 miles from my house. And at the time, I didn't know what was going on. But I did get an Apple IIe computer when I was really young. And I wonder if that had something to do with it. You know, if it was just because I don't know. My dad was a construction worker. I don't know why he would have known about that or why getting a computer was like such an urgent thing other than the fact that perhaps we were, you know, in the epicenter of it.
Didn't he get it as a bonus from work? Like, wasn't his work directly involved in the computer?
No, I think he and my mom decided to buy the computer. And it was, I mean, this is, 1982. And so the Apple IIe was $4,000 in 1982 dollars. I mean, it was very, very expensive. And again, he was an electrician. So it wasn't, this was a splurge for both of my parents. And it was a Christmas present to both my brother and I. And it was, you know, I had a single little floppy drive, a green monochrome monitor, and a clacky keyboard, and that was pretty much it. We didn't get a printer. We didn't have, there was obviously no hard drives back then, and it was kind of like typing on a mainframe. You know, it's the cutting edge of technology, but looking back now, when my kids, I showed our eldest a YouTube video of someone typing on one the other day, and he said, that looks ancient.
Well, it is ancient in technology years.
It is.
So
ancient.
You were, what, 7 or 8 then when you
yep.
got the Apple IIe?
Yeah.
What did you do with it? What did you make of it, having this odd computer in your house?
Well, there wasn't much you could do with it because the games or programs, as they called them then, now we call them apps or applications, but they were $50 a piece, again, in 1982 dollars, and we didn't have anywhere near that. So we bought this book called I Speak Basic to My Apple. And it was about learning this basic programming language. And so if you wanted it to do something, for the most part, you had to write the programs. You had to build the games. There were some open source games out there. It wasn't called open source. It was, I'm trying to think of what it was, like shareware or something, I think is the term. And so there was a lemonade stand game and a few others. But for the most part, I was an 8-year-old and my brother was 3 years older. We would type in these programs from these books, and anytime we could get our hands on new code, we would type it in, and that was the initial dopamine rush, right? Was being able to type a bunch of words and then have it do something intricate that you didn't expect, and then slowly learning what those commands meant. It's like learning to speak a new language by being immersed in it.
What were the first like aha moments for you, or like what hooked you in? How did you know that you loved playing with this particular toy?
I was fascinated by the fact that, you know, as an 8-year-old, you don't have a lot of influence on the world, on your outside world. Like you're told to go to school, you're told to do homework, you watch TV, you read, you play with action figures. I mean, that was, you know, those are the memories of my life. And yet in this one glimpse, this one window, I could sit at this machine and I could impact my world. I could impact the world by writing a program that someone else might use. And that was a very unique thing, to have influence and to be able to create something that in my 8-year-old mind was somehow changing the world in a way that I had almost no other avenue in my life to do.
Like it gave you this kind of incredible power.
Yeah, that's right. And I must have seen movies like War Games and stuff where I saw people on computers, and to be able to get on a computer myself and be able to kind of wield some of that power was game changing. And not only that, it wasn't just about the power, but I remember learning the languages very quickly and feeling like my mind spoke the same language as the computer. Like it just all made sense very quickly. Right. And I took to it. I imagine some people are naturally gifted with, you know, hand-eye coordination, and they throw footballs and they become the quarterback of the football team or whatever, or the captain of the volleyball team. And I played sports as well. But like the thing that has always resonated with me from the time I was 8 until today, when I'm still hacking PHP scripts on the weekends, is that there's something about the logic and the way that you code that really fits the way that my mind works.
In my conversation with Jason Cohen, we talked about this kind of experience as like native language, that you sort of feel like you came into this language or this ability to code, and it was not something that you had to learn. It was almost second nature. It felt really automatic for your brain.
Yeah, it was a long time ago, but that's my memory of it. So not only was it easy, but other people, I remember people saying, wow, these things are really complicated, or this is really hard. You know, whether it was my mom or relatives would come over, and it just all made sense to me. And it was something I could do that few others could do. My brother and I basically knew how to work it. And that was also, as an 8-year-old, something that's kind of cool to have a unique skill, you know, that others don't.
So you started at 8, and did you, you know, march on through to yesterday? Like, you've been coding your whole life. Were there ever times when you fell out of love or didn't like it very much?
You know, I coded a lot until about 7th or 8th grade, and I built a lot of kind of text-based adventure games and fairly intricate lemonade stand games with randomizers to determine what's going to happen on this day. And, you know, intricate by my 10-year-old, 12-year-old standards. And then computers weren't cool. And so in high school, I left it all behind for like sports and whatever else people do in high school, driving around, hanging out at the 7-Eleven. So I walked away from it. And it's years that I feel like, I don't know that I regret it per se, but I do wish that I had been more authentic to myself and who I was, because during those years, I was always thinking about either coding or even just playing games. I used to play, you know, a bunch of adventure games on the computer, and I took about a 4 or 5 year hiatus, and it was fine. But I, you know, certainly when I got into college and I was majoring in electrical engineering and realized that computer engineering was just like a couple extra quarters to get a double major. And so when I started doing that, I had to take programming courses, and it kind of rekindled that desire to start coding again on my own. Now, I hated coding in class because it was all structured, and I, you know, had been hacking my own stuff for years. And so I had my own styles, and I had to adjust to the styles of the class. But I definitely remember it igniting the spark again, right? Almost like an addiction, where it's like, oh yeah, I forgot what this feels like.
So you took a hiatus in high school to sort of do high school things, girls and dating and football and 7-Eleven.
Yep.
And sounds like you were working on a different set of skills during that time.
Often unsuccessfully.
Hey, you did okay. So when did you catch the entrepreneurial bug?
That was also when I was young. That was a means to an end, because we didn't have much money. And I remember saving up like Kool-Aid, the UPC barcode symbols to like send in to get my first Walkman. And it was like the cheapest, the absolute cheapest piece of crap Walkman you can imagine. And so it was a cassette player, obviously. And for that, I needed batteries. And my parents, we just didn't have batteries around the house like you do these days. There wasn't Costco, there wasn't Amazon. So I had to like save up money for batteries. And if I wanted to listen to my music, I needed batteries. And so I was trying to figure out, how do I make money here? We had no allowance. We made a dollar an hour if we wanted to work. And so I used to grab a weed whacker, and I would weed whack in the middle of the summer in the Bay Area. And it was, I'm sounding like an old guy, but I mean, it was 100 degrees and I was all sweaty and tired and stuff, but I'd work 6 or 7 hours a day in order to make money. And I started thinking, there has to be a better way. Like, this is too hard. Too hard. And I would do that for several days at a time. And then I'm like, this sucks. You know, I got to figure out a better way. So that was when I went back to school. You know, I was into collecting comic books at the time. And I realized that I went to the comic store once a month and a bunch of other kids did not. And so I started kind of getting them into the hobby. And I would then buy at a small discount at the store, and I would bring them in and sell them at a small markup from cover price. And so I was just a middleman at that point, but you know, I was making 50 cents a book or something. And you know, when you compare it to a dollar an hour, it's kind of a big deal. You know, kids didn't have the outlet to go get their own. So even though I was charging more than cover price, I was making, you know, a few bucks here and there doing that.
What were your other early entrepreneurial endeavors?
The one that was most successful was I bought a bunch of candy at Price Club, right? This is before Costco and Price Club merged. And I remember getting Now and Laters, like 100 Now and Later packs in a bucket or whatever it is, you know, a small plastic jar. And I got them for 3 cents a piece, and I sold them for 25 cents. So I spent $3 of the money that I had earned from this other stuff, and I parlayed it into $25. And I remember looking at that, you know, over the course of weeks selling those and being like, this is the most money I've ever seen. And it was good. I was kind of addicted to it at that point. Like, boy, I really got to do this. And then people started coming to me at school for that. You know, they're like, hey, do you have any blow pops? And it's like, no, but I can hook you up. You know, like I started to become the dealer. It was...
You became, the candy dealer at school.
Yeah.
Did you ever get in trouble?
No. The only time I got in trouble was, you know, again, I was a kid, so you have to forgive this one, but I would bootleg tapes, cassette tapes, so music. And I had this whole list that I printed up on the computer, and I'm like, these are all the albums that I have. And if you, I forget what I even charged. It was like, you pay $2 and then either give me a blank cassette or another $2 and I will copy the tape for you, basically. And I didn't realize at the time that this was piracy, but that's what it was. So I did some of that, and the principal got pretty mad. I think both because I was doing it, and he told me, you know, this is illegal, and I didn't know that. But then there was foul language, right? It was rap music, and so he got really upset about the music. And so I actually stopped doing that at that point when he came and talked to me.
So your dad's a construction worker, an electrician, and your mom's at home and then also raising dogs, had a dog kennel. I mean, what do they make of you and your coding and you of your candy pushing business?
Yeah, it's interesting. They definitely encouraged the coding, but they kind of didn't need to. I mean, they would, you know how they encouraged it is they gave me unlimited time to do it. And I would sit there and code for 4, 5, 6 hours straight because you're in the zone, right? You're in flow and you're trying to build something. That I think was one of the biggest gifts that they gave, is that they didn't say, oh, you only get 30 minutes to do this. Cause I was able to go so deep in some of this stuff and learn it so well just by spending time. And then the entrepreneurial stuff, they didn't know most of it was going on, but then I remember talking to them about it once and they said, this is great. You should do this. This is a good way to make money. And they were kind of impressed that I had thought of it or that they said, you have these entrepreneurial instincts, you should follow those. But that was it. There was no conversation there. I don't remember there being many conversations beyond that, other than it was definitely encouragement.
Do you have a sense of where that came from in you? Is it kind of intrinsic? Is it just this need to solve a problem in an easier way, like selling candy versus weed whacking? Or is there something in your family or in your parents or in the ways that you were raised that fostered that?
There really wasn't anything in the way I was raised, honestly. I've thought about this a lot. No one else in my family is an entrepreneur. None of my extended family was. I had no model. I had no mentor. Like, I don't know why it happened other than I wanted to make money to buy batteries and to buy more comics and to buy the things that I wanted as a kid. And I didn't know, there was just no other way that I knew of to do it.
Another piece of at least what I know about your story that we haven't yet touched on is that you were also very active in creating your own things. So writing your own comic books, even pursuing patents for inventions when you were in junior high and high school.
Yeah, I mean, to touch on all those things, like I wound up getting paid to write a couple scripts for some independent publishers. That was in college. But I mean, it was like $100 to write a script for an entire comic, which is a lot of time. But that was interesting. I was a sophomore in college, and it was something I loved to do. I wrote booklets like on how to collect comic books. I wrote one on how to kind of become a comic book artist that I researched a bunch of other books and kind of compiled it into a booklet. And I was selling those through classified ads. Those were never that successful. You know, I was selling these booklets for 10. It's kind of like the info products, right? It's like what eBooks are today is what it was then. And I had read about someone doing it. And so I said, screw it, I'm going to do that. And given the cost of copying and classified ads and all that, I didn't make money. I was doing that in high school, I think.
The other one that I was thinking of was inventions. Like didn't you pursue a patent for your hanger helper?
I did. So that was also, boy, that was late high school. And I think I actually started pursuing a couple of those in college, but it was the typical, you know, it's funny these days I would go on Shark Tank, right? But I just had ideas. I mean, like any of us, like I had ideas for stuff. And I remember thinking like there were certain clothes that I wore multiple times, like a nice dress shirt or something, or a coat, a sports coat that my dad had got me. And I was like, how many times have I worn this? And should I wear it again? And I remember thinking there should be a counter attached to hangers. And I called it the hanger helper, stupidest name ever. But I didn't apply for a patent because it's really expensive. But I talked to a couple of these. Like, what are they? They're like organizations that help inventors get patents and do stuff. And so I did a drawing and I did all the kind of the work to submit for a patent, but like to actually do it and do it right, it's 10 grand or 20 grand to submit. And I didn't have the money and I also didn't have the confidence that it was actually that good of an idea.
You were sure it was a $20,000 idea?
I was not sure it was going to make me a thousandaire. So it was just a little bit too big of a risk.
You know, most people just smell the armpits.
I know. Now I realize that. That's the most people solve things in a very normal way. And I think entrepreneurs sometimes overthink these things.
What were the things that were hard for you as you were growing up? What struggles did you sort of have to battle with that shaped who you've become as an adult?
I battled with lack of self-confidence, especially early on. And I was scared, like a timid, anxious, scared kid. I remember not liking social interactions very much. I was fine socially. It wasn't like I was super awkward, but I just always felt like other kids were mean. And I always had a group of friends, but the whole dynamics and the politics of school all the way from, you know, junior high through high school was just the most irritating thing for me, that people wasted time and that I had to waste time worrying about what jeans I wore and worrying about what my hair looked like. And I didn't have any guidance of how I should be styling my hair, and B, I didn't have the money to buy the right hair gel that other people were using. So my hair looked different. I mean, it pissed me off the whole time. And I was, you know, I wanted more social connection with, of course, the popular people, which in retrospect, I regret, because I don't think that would have been at all interesting for me. But that was a struggle growing up. I also, there was a big struggle with my dad, who has OCD, like clinically really bad.
Obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yep. And people joke, you know, or even say, oh, I'm really OCD about XYZ. And when people say that, totally doesn't offend me, but I think to myself, nope, you're not, you know, you're maybe a little bit type A about something. Like, I've seen OCD. Like, I know what it looks like. My dad didn't leave his bedroom for 7 months when I was a senior in high school. And he basically almost lost his job, but he was protected because he'd worked for the company for 30 years. And the basically chairman of the board said, you know, we're going to keep him on payroll. And he eventually returned and did really well. But that time was crazy. I mean, my family kind of was imploding. My brother was at college. My mom was struggling to keep my dad sane, in essence. I mean, an OCD person looks kind of like an insane person at times. And, you know, that was my junior and senior year of high school when I was finally coming into my own in terms of like self-confidence. And I was doing really well at track. I went to the state track meet, qualified for that. Like, I was really doing it. But at the same time, like, my personal life was just crumbling. My home life was completely unstable. And that was one of the hardest times of my life, I would say.
Your dad's a really important person in your life. Sorry, I'm getting all choked up.
Wow. I made the interviewer cry.
Just go ahead and say something about your dad.
Yeah, my dad was my best friend growing up, and it was hard to see him go through that. You know, it's something he'll struggle with his whole life. Now, luckily, he, you know, they didn't even know what OCD was until, I don't know, the mid-80s, late 80s. And so this was the early 90s, and they finally had a few medicines that people could start taking. And so he was on medication, and it fixed that. Or, you know, I shouldn't say fixed it. It helped him get through it and get back to work. And he had a successful, he had a really good run after that, actually, because the dot-com, he had become a project manager, and the dot-com boom came after that. And he, you know, those were kind of the best earning years of his life and kind of the most successful. And so I do feel like he had a great, great second act, you know, before he retired in the early 2000s. And he still has OCD, but it's not, you know, he can get around and do normal stuff, but you can see it. If you know him, you can see the stuff that still hampers his life. OCD is an anxiety disorder. And so it makes sense that as a kid, I had anxiety, and that my, you know, my brother has it, and that my dad would just live with that. And so that's been a thing, that risk aversion. You know, I often say I'm an entrepreneur, but I'm risk averse. And it's because I often think about worst case scenarios. And I think that that comes from upbringing and probably from some genetics as well.
Yeah, there's always this challenge of how to manage your fear and how much to listen to it, which can help you make wise decisions when it comes to risk, but also how much to fight it.
That's right. And I think I've learned, if anything, I've learned that it's like knowing yourself. If you are crazy and you do impulsive stuff, then you should probably reel that back a little. And I am on the other end of the spectrum where I'm risk averse and don't want to take risks. So I tend to try to push myself to take more risks and to fight through the fear of things and to ask myself, why am I scared of this? Is it a real thing, or is it just something in my head? And then sometimes I completely freak out and then say things like, what have I done spending $30,000 on Hitsale?
Yeah. And you need someone outside of you to just be like, it's fine.
No, that's right. To get a sanity check.
As you look back on kind of your early life experience and, you know, now being in your mid 40s and like having done a lot of things and achieved a lot of success, what are you most grateful for about the way that you were raised or the way that your life was when you were a kid?
I'm extremely grateful that my parents, both of them, built us up. They told us that we were great, and they told us that we would be great someday, and told us that we were smart. And like, I never, you know, I've heard of parents who just rag on their kids or say that they're never going to be anything or don't instill self-confidence in the kids. And that may be the, like, one of the biggest things that fought against all the voices in my head over the years is them trying to instill this sense of, you are going to be something, that you're going to do interesting things in your life.
Do they think they recognize that in you now?
I do. Yeah, they've both told me that, actually.
And how is that shaping how you raise your children?
Well, I certainly, you know, am deliberate about telling the kids when they're doing doing good stuff and that they're going to be something. It's also balance. I don't want to brainwash the kids into thinking that they don't have to work hard, because that's the other thing is when I was young, like obviously talking about whacking weeds in 100-degree weather, I did that a lot. Like I have many, many memories of that. And so I also knew that I had to work hard to achieve the things that my parents were talking about. And that, I think, is the balance, is trying to raise our kids to understand what hard work is. And this stuff doesn't just fall in your lap. And then I think the third thing, to be honest, the other thing I'm grateful for is that I had time to explore. Like I said, that I had hours and hours to invest in stuff and that I didn't piss it away playing Nintendo. You know, I didn't like become really good at Super Mario. That we lived out in the country. The only TV station we got was PBS. I had a ton of books. So I didn't hang out with the kids in the neighborhood because we lived in the country. So I wasn't like a lot of my friends lived near each other and would play games. And I always wanted to do that, but I was almost forced into this isolation. And I think that was actually a blessing because it forced me to be in my own head and to like read and write. And I learned so much from PBS. It's just, I cannot underscore how important like this early life education stuff was. And it just gave me a perspective on the world that I'm not sure I would have gotten had I grown up in a, you know, in a suburban neighborhood with kind of the normal grammar school, junior high life that a lot of my friends did.
Yeah, the lines between your early life and your adulthood are pretty clean in the sense that like you were such a learner then, you were such a creator, you were so willing to just jump into something, figure it out, learn how to be creative. You were a writer, those things sound sort of like lofty maybe, or, you know, you sound like this sort of Renaissance man as a child, but it's also very much who you have always been and still continue to be. And I guess one of the reasons that I love doing these interviews, and it's even fun to talk to you about this, even though I, you know your story so well, is that when you feel sort of adrift or when you feel like you're at a point in your life where you're like, I'm not really sure what I'm about, I feel like it is so helpful to look back and be like, oh my gosh, I really knew who I was. Even as a child, the things that I was drawn to, the things that I spent my time on, the things that I did, they're still applicable today.
Yeah, I would agree. Just at a different scale, right? It's about learning, like this hunger to learn new things, a hunger to push things into the world, and a hunger for creativity. And creativity, maybe not in the traditional sense. I've never been like an artist or a sculptor, or I do a little bit of music here and there, but certainly not. I wouldn't say I'm anything great at it, but it's like creating something out of nothing, right? Creating podcasts out of nothing, creating a blog, creating a conference, software, companies, and whatever it is, songs. You know, I still like to write songs. And there's something about that that has always inspired me, I guess. I mean, it's a double-edged sword because it sounds great, but it's also, I become really angsty and frankly kind of sad when I'm unable to do those things. When I'm not able to push things into the world, when I'm not learning, and when I'm not able to create at a level that I feel like befits what I'm trying to do.
Well, you're angsty because you're kind of, you're getting away from your native language, from your essence, your true self.
Totally. And that was the hard part of like having normal jobs. I didn't fit in normal companies. Like the longest job I ever had was 2.5 years, and it was way overdue that when I left there. Like I don't fit that normal corporate hierarchy, and large teams of people don't tend to be my thing. I think it comes back to perhaps being that loner as a kid, you know? Even though there was family around me, it was like I wanted to do a lot of stuff on my own. And so that, I struggled with that. I mean, you remember from 2000 until probably 2008 when I really went out on my own, I was like, man, I was ashamed of my resume, remember? Because I was job hopping, because I would work a job for 8 months and I'm like, this is terrible. This sucks. So I would hop it, you know, to the next one. And then I'd work for a couple of years and then I was a contractor. And it wasn't that I was a deadbeat, right? Or that I was, you know, can't get along with other people, because I do get along with other people. It's just, I don't.
Every job you were in was desperate for you to stay.
That's right. That was the difference, right? I wasn't being asked to leave. I was so unhappy at those jobs that I kept seeking, what am I going to be happy doing? And that, of course, leads you down the path of entrepreneurship.
And here we are today.
Yeah, indeed.
Any last things that you want to say about your origins, where you came from? I feel like it's worth at least telling like a little story about the fact that your mom had a dog kennel in your house while you were growing up. Yeah. So it was chaotic.
It totally was. We had my mom and it was my parents, but really it was my mom's thing. And they had 30 something dogs the entire time we were growing up. It was Chinese Sharpei. They're the wrinkly dogs that you see on calendars. Super cute. And they were almost extinct in the mid 70s. And my mom got one of the first that came over from China. And they bred the dogs and they kind of, were part of the people who were revitalizing the breed. And we had a kennel on our property, which is 2 acres of land in the East Bay. And then we had 6 or 7 adult dogs in the house at any given time. And then we often had litters of puppies, 1 or 2 litters in the house. So my house was very supportive of us, but it was complete chaos all the time. It was just like people milling in and out, relatives and friends and puppies and dogs. And it was and as a kid, that's actually a really good vibe to be around because there's energy and weirdness, in terms of like, no one else lives like this. Like people would come over and be like, what is this house? Like friends would come over and they were just tripping. And then I would go to their house and I'm like, wow, everything's really clean here.
You don't have any dogs.
Everything's really orderly. You don't have any dogs? And then I'm like, it smells so different here. Like it just was completely oblivious when you grow up in an environment that is so different than anything else that, anyone lives under.
And I also see why you needed to retreat to some quiet time in your room to just focus on something, because it was so loud and chaotic all the time that quiet focus was kind of a counterbalance to that.
Yeah, I think so. And I enjoyed both of them. I have fond memories of all the dogs and the people and the conversations. And then I have fond memories of being in my room plunking away on that plastic case, Apple IIe, for hours on end.
Well, it seems like a good place to leave it.
Yeah.
All right. I know you got to get to work. Thanks for squeezing this in. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on the show. thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for twisting my pinky.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Founder. Our theme song is A New Beginning by bensound.com, used under Creative Commons.